Today is September the 5th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key. My colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on WBAI.org/archive. We're also on PRN.FM and on our website, PCRadioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are a little different. Later in the feature segment, in which I covered from the tech corner, I will be talking about reinstalling Windows 10 from a free upgrade of 7 or 8.1. And I'll be covering also, is getting the new 2018 iPhone worth going into debt? But before we get to all that, let's get to the news. Apple has had to warn customers of a more clear and present danger to existing models. Taking to its official website, Apple warned customers that models of its iPhone 8 contain logic boards with a manufacturing defect. Affected devices may experience unexpected restarts, a frozen screen, or won't turn on. Apple says it has determined that only a very small percentage of iPhone 8 models are affected. Apple says the issue impacts iPhone 8 models made across a six-month time period between September 2017 and March 2018 in China, Hong Kong, India, Japan, Macau, New Zealand, and the United States. The good news is Apple has a simple way to check your phone's eligibility. You simply enter the serial number in its checker and Apple will repair it free of charge. The service will also be available to owners for 3 years after the first retail sale of the unit, and the iPhone 8 Plus and iPhone X are not impacted. But don't get too excited yet. iPhone 8 owners thinking they can send in a damaged unit or phones in poor condition should read the fine print. Apple warns, if your iPhone 8 has any damage which impairs the ability to complete the repair, such as a cracked screen, that issue would need to be resolved prior to the service. In some cases, there may be a cost associated with the additional repair. So be careful, because damage you can live with and may not be tolerated by Apple repair team, and fixing an iPhone 8 chassis is seriously expensive. You can also expect your iPhone 8 to be running the latest version of iOS when it's returned to you, something which is not always welcomed by its owner. Apple's warning means serious hardware faults have now affected the iPhone 8, iPhone 7, and iPhone 6. This may put you off the company's upcoming and all-new iPhone 9. Google announced several new online tools designed to help former members of the military find jobs or attract new customers to their businesses. One tool allows vets to type in the search term jobs for veterans, followed by specific military job codes to see civilian jobs with skill requirements that match their service experience. The military job code feature also has been deployed to Google's Cloud Talent solution, which is used by FedEx, Encompass Health Careers, Siemens, Career Builders, and others. They hope to use their technology to help veterans understand the full range of opportunities open to them across many different fields. Right now, those opportunities are getting lost in translation. There isn't a common language that helps recruiters match a veteran's experience with the need for their skills and leadership in civilian jobs. As a result, 1 in 3 veterans of the roughly 250,000 service members who transition out of the military each year end up taking jobs well below their skill level. A tool that acts as a sort of Rosetta Stone for translating military experience into civilian skills is valuable to recruiters as well as job seekers. For recruiters, it's not always immediately obvious how skills picked up in the military translate into the business world. In the military, humility, for example, can work against someone making a transition from the service to civilian life. In a business setting, you have to promote things you've done and let people know about your accomplishments as part of networking, while in a military setting, that might sound like bragging. In addition, soft skills learned in the military may be overlooked. Leadership, commitment, and character are all things that have value in the business world. Online job search tools geared towards military experience are helpful for employers who put a premium on hiring veterans or looking for certain skill sets. However, there's still a problem of skills that could be useful in the private sector but don't translate well into the civilian job market. Warriors for Wireless, which retrains veterans for jobs in the communications and wireless tower industries. There are certain skill sets that don't work. There is not much of a market for torpedo techs or bombardiers in the private sector, except with some defense contractors. But even these skills should be evaluated for leadership, management, hard work, and reliability. Google's commitment to help veterans find a role in a civilian work environment is positive, especially as because its approach is to treat military service and experience like college. For example, if you major in an area of study, you use that keyword in your job search and include it in a resume. By taking the military occupational specialty code, defining the skills and what that veteran did in that service, then matching it to the occupation, it more accurately translates the skills for the targeted job. There are disadvantages to using specialty codes to profile job candidates, though. It puts the veteran's specific skill sets in a box and can limit options. When you're in the military, you're assigned jobs, but you may also have the capacity to excel in another position. By limiting veterans to their specific roles via these tools, they may not have the opportunity to work outside of their comfort zone or to do a job they like or could thrive in. The latest release of Chrome is Chrome version 69. Chrome is releasing an entire new design for Chrome with new features and tweaks to the browser's overall appearance. But one of the big new features is an improved password manager. Chrome will now offer to automatically generate a random password when you sign up to websites for the first time. This password will be stored inside a Chrome Google account securely and sync across desktop and mobile versions of Chrome. This should stop regular Chrome users from always picking the same password for each site, and ultimately ending up with a security headache if a site is breached. Chrome's password manager is a welcome change, but you may still want to use a dedicated and separate password manager. Chrome only manages passwords inside its browser, so if you sign into various mobile apps or apps on a TV like Netflix, then those login combinations won't be stored in a Google account. That's particularly relevant now that iOS 12 is about to introduce the ability to autofill passwords across browsers and apps from third-party password managers. Google's choice is to offer a password generator and manager will likely trigger debate about best password practices. Some security experts argue web users should simply remember a long and memorable phrase for each password, while others recommend a random password with special characters that's managed by a password manager. Both options should still take modern computers years to crack. Until systems get faster or the age of quantum computing finally arrives, we're hoping the entire industry has figured out a more reliable way to get rid of pesky passwords once and for all. So if you're not running with Chrome 69, that is now the latest version. You should download it and install it. In our listening audience, we do have a number of people who are, well, they're movie nuts. MoviePass, the monthly $10 subscription service that enables ones to watch a movie in the theater free, is no more. Less than a month ago, it was a thriving, totally economically unsustainable way of taking money directly from venture capitalist and putting it towards your third viewing of the, well, whatever your favorite movie is. Now all that remains is a sad and empty husk, a show of its former self. MoviePass is dead. Long live MoviePass. In the early days, MoviePass allowed users to see unlimited movies at participating theaters for prices that range as high as $100 and, well, as low as whatever you can get into the theater for the participating theater. At that point, it was still a niche service, catering largely to the movie audience in cities like New York, where ticket prices can creep above the $20 mark. But the service wasn't growing, so MoviePass decided to take drastic measures, namely dousing the company in gasoline and driving it off the edge of the Grand Canyon and light it with a cigarette and have it disappeared. Last summer, MoviePass dropped its unlimited plan to $10, and suddenly, everyone's mom was wearing a turtleneck sweater and talking about the deeper meaning of whatever movie they were watching. For a brief and exhilarating window, the deluded millionaires behind MoviePass democratized moviegoing. There's a big studio myth that audiences aren't going to the movies because there are too many other options, because Netflix and Amazon and the golden age of TV are drawing people away from movie theaters. It's a myth that MoviePass punctured. People still want to see movies. The issue is that going to the movie is just, well, it's gotten very expensive. But, as we all know, that first beautiful year of MoviePass was a dream too beautiful to last. MoviePass crumbled in August and downgraded to a $10, three movies a month plan. Instead of being able to see anything, you're given a predetermined list of films to pick from. The service has grown more and more unreliable in recent months, with screenings outright disappearing and total lack of customer service. I would argue that, especially in New York, where ticket prices to see a 2D movie is around $17, it's still technically worth it. But if you can scrap your way into just one movie this month, you're still saving money with MoviePass. But it seems increasingly likely that it stays as a functioning company unnumbered. If you're in the market for replacement, there are several options. There is SignMia Offers, that's SignMiaOffers, the same $10, three movie plans as MoviePass, with the added bonus of being able to purchase tickets in advance. And AMC A-List is probably your best bet if you're angling to just see a big release. The theater chain subscription service will get you three movies a week, including IMAX and 3D for only $20 a month. In time, someone in a few years from now would say, "You remember something called MoviePass?" When someone else is talking about, "You remember the 45 RPM donut?" Amazon is launching a free video service. The Seattle-based web giant is developing a free advertising-supported video service for the 48 million people who use its Fire TV streaming video devices. Amazon's service, which reportedly is being developed by IMDb, which is their subsidiary of Movie Titles, would compete with Roku and others for a chunk of the $70 billion U.S. advertising business. Anytime Amazon is making headlines around you, investors tend to get concerned. Such ad inventory is based on data collected from the companies to target consumers. In the past year, Roku advertising business has been in the $200 million ballpark. Amazon's other revenue growth, which includes advertising and Prime subscription, as central to its increasingly large, high-margin revenue streams. Amazon is in the process of expanding its streaming footprint in order to take on giants such as Netflix. Earlier this week, Bloomberg reported that Amazon was in talks with Sony and Paramount to offer more movies. Citing anonymous sources, the report said options included development funds as well as money for film productions. Mozilla changes Firefox policy from Do Not Track to will not track. Firefox will stop asking nicely for privacy protection. Mozilla said it would soon be modifying its Firefox browser to block all user tracking on websites by default. In the near future, Firefox will, by default, protect users by blocking tracking while also offering a clear set of controls to give users more choice over what information they will share with sites. The move will see an initial trial being released this month, and should that work out, the Firefox 63 rollout will include a component to immediately block slow-loading trackers. By the time Firefox 65 is released, Mozilla said it hopes to have all cross-site tracking blocked by default. The move means a shift by Mozilla from the more passive do-not-track system that relies on sites to recognize the notice and disable their trackers to an active feature that will instead block tracking by default and require the user themselves to opt in to the website trackers. Users will have the option to enable trackers by default, and Mozilla plans to also add options to allow blocks for slow-loading trackers or third-party cookies. Hackers can steal your Android unlock pattern by turning your phone into a sonar system. New research from researchers in Sweden and the UK reveals that hackers would be able to steal the unlock pattern of your Android phone by turning the device into an improvised sonar system, using the speakers and microphones in a handset. The sonar would be able to pick up the movements of fingers against the screen and determine possible patterns that could unlock the phone. The technique is called Sonar Snoop. It's something that has been reported by ZDNet, and it uses Finger I.O. as the primary source of inspiration. Finger I.O. is a smartwatch interaction model published back in March of 2016, which proposes the use of a sonar-like system to pick up hand gestures and translate them into actions on the screen. Sonar Snoop, meanwhile, is the malicious version of Finger I.O., but you shouldn't panic over it. Using this method, hackers would be able to reduce the number of possible unlock patterns by 70%, thanks to the machine learning algorithm built into the attack. But deploying the attack in the real world isn't terribly realistic, at least not in this day and age. As it stands right now, you shouldn't even rely on unlock patterns to protect your phone. Most Android phones ship with fingerprint sensors, which are a lot more secure than pattern unlocks. If you use an older device, you might want to set up a strong password or passcode rather than unlock pattern, even if the latter feels more convenient. Also, you can set up your phone to wipe all data after a number of failed unlock attempts. Finally, make sure your Android gadget runs the latest software available for it, especially when it comes to security patches. If you do use an old Android phone that lacks a fingerprint sensor and you like unlock patterns, then make sure you don't install Android apps from unknown sources. Stick to the Google Play Store to avoid installing malware. For Sonar Snoop to work, a malware app would have to be installed on the phone. And if hackers get you to install malware on your device, they may be able to spy on your every move without even having to steal your unlock pattern. Yahoo still scans users' emails for data to sell to advertisers, a practice that many tech companies have moved away from. This is as reported by the Wall Street Journal. Yahoo's owner, Oath, is in talks with advertisers to provide a service that would analyze over 200 million Yahoo Mail inboxes for consumer data. And this is as reported by the Wall Street Journal. Oath did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Oath, which is owned by Verizon, confirmed to the Wall Street Journal that it performs email scannings and said that it only scans promotional emails, usually from retailers. Users have the ability to opt out, it said, and Oath's argument is that Email is an expensive system, and people can't expect a free service without some value exchange. The opt-out page, however, is hard to find. Even the emails in Yahoo's premium email service, which costs $3.49 a month, are subject to the analysis, unless users opt out. To opt out, you have to specifically head into the Ad Internet Manager and select opt out. The page is not located in settings, which makes it difficult to find. Oath uses algorithms to sort Yahoo emails by different consumer preferences and places cookies that will show users similar advertising in the future. For instance, users who often buy plane tickets are labeled frequent flyers by Oath algorithms. Those who receive emails inviting them to drive for Lyft are sorted as self-employed. Advertisers can then target these groups of users when taking out ads with Oath. Personal emails are ignored, and personally identifiable information is hidden from the data that's given to the advertisers. Oath told the Wall Street Journal the algorithm has made mistakes before. Invitations to traditional Indian weddings that can be sent to a large number of recipients and take place over several days were mistakenly labeled as commercial emails, which Oath then had to correct. Now wedding invitations are also ignored. The process of reviewing these emails requires human readers as well as algorithm sorting. As was reported in April, Oath's privacy policy allows it to read AOL and Yahoo emails to tailor ads, and that includes human readers, not just machines. The move looks like Oath is scrapping the bottom of the barrel with its email system, with its email service, as it struggles to combat the more popular Gmail system. Though many people use Yahoo Mail as their spam account that collects unwanted emails from retailers, and that's precisely what advertisers could capitalize on. Still, advertisers expressed doubt if Yahoo Mail was even big enough to send highly targeted ads. Even if Oath provided data from 200 million accounts, only a few of those users would have bought specific items. Yahoo has also struggled with a series of data breaches that have marred its reputation. Every single Yahoo account, that's a total of 3 billion users, were hacked in 2013 to 2017. And now featuring Health and Wearable Technologies by Dr. Alfred Poor. He'll be talking about smartphone app helps avoid opioid relapse, and he'll cover eye movements can diagnose disease and injury, and finally, he will be covering Blue Cross and Fitbit partner for healthier members.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
I'm going to start tonight with a story that has some elements that are probably familiar and some other ones that may not be so familiar to you. The familiar part is, unfortunately, the epidemic of opioid addiction in this country and around the world. And we need to get a handle on how to deal with this. Part of the problem comes from the fact that we are a medication-oriented society. We tend to take a pill to try to fix whatever's wrong. The unfamiliar part of the story, though, is that there's a movement towards non-medication forms of treatment. I've spoken here a number of times about electrostimulation devices that provide relief from pain or other conditions without chemicals, without medicines. But there's also this whole interesting movement of digital health. We're actually seeing software applications being prescribed just as if they were medicines. Smartphone applications that are designed to help treat a medical condition. And in this particular case, we're talking about a company called DataCube. They have a program called Rescue, and it's designed to help people who are in recovery from opioid addiction. And the way that the program works is it focuses on two separate audiences. The first audience is made up of the recovering patients who are dealing with their addiction and trying to avoid relapses. And then the second audience is their network of supporters, the family and friends and health workers and so forth who were there to support them in their recovery process. This rescue app on a smartphone, what it does is it monitors the condition of the patient, and then based on what's going on in their lives at that point, what their situation is, what their moods are, it presents different sort of games and activities for the patient to participate in. This helps the patient avoid some of the triggers that might cause a relapse, but it also then notifies the support network how the patient is doing, if there are particular problems they may have, some warning signs in the patient's behavior, and it also reports on their successes. So it uses both sides of the reinforcement to make sure that the patient stays on track with their recovery. On a larger scope, this whole concept of being able to use software on smartphones to address medical conditions is kind of novel and very interesting. We know that these devices have had a huge impact on our behavior, on our society, and it's good to see that there is some way that they can be used to help relieve problems and not just cause them. One of the big problems in diagnosing many different kinds of medical conditions is that the process is really subjective. You ask the patient a bunch of questions, you look and see what some of the test results are, and it's kind of difficult to be objective about some of the calls. Take a patient with early dementia. Do they have Alzheimer's? It's not really clear how you can diagnose it, identify without a doubt whether the patient has that condition or not. Take another one. In sports, the problem with head impacts resulting in concussion is very difficult. It's possible for a single impact to provide a concussive injury for a player. It's also possible for a series of smaller impacts to have a negative impact on their cognition and, you know, cause possible brain injury. And yet other players may undergo the same impacts with no ill effects. So we have ways of asking them questions and, you know, different kinds of concussion protocols that they go through. Well, there's a company called Cicadas that is getting technology designed to provide objective information for making these kinds of calls. Basically, what they do is they have eye tracking software. You may not realize it, but when you're looking at something, your eye is actually twitching. They call these saccades. These are tiny little motions that your eye makes, and you don't even notice them. But it's an important part of our vision system. It turns out that these saccades, these tiny little jerky motions that your eye makes, differ with healthy people compared with people with different kinds of diseases. In the case of concussion, this company, Cicadas, has done some clinical research that has produced some very interesting results. They have one case study of a basketball player where they were able to take a baseline measure of their eye movements following an object tracking on a screen. They were able to record that at the beginning of the season as a base level. In the course of playing throughout the season, this particular player suffered blows to both the front and back of their head. They lost vision temporarily. They were seeing double. There was concern about them having a concussion. The eye tracking software, taken 3 days after the injury occurred, demonstrated clearly that the right eye was not performing normally compared to how it had been performing the original baseline measure. And then 8 days later, the right eye performance was back to its normal levels, and the player was cleared to continue playing basketball again. So this provided objective data to show that, yes, the control of the eye was impaired as a result of that impact, and it was also able to determine when the eye motion had returned to normal levels again. And the interesting thing is that this same technology, they've researched other applications for it. They have clinical data showing how it can be used to help identify Alzheimer's and cognitive impairment. It also can be shown to help predict whether a Parkinson's patient is more likely to be a fall risk or not. And it's not a guess. It's not subjective. It's not based on a bunch of open-ended questions. Instead, it's based on hard data that can be obtained by measuring the movement of the eye. So this could be an important step forward to help us identify conditions and help patients get treatment promptly. This probably won't come as any surprise, but about 40% of American adults are obese. 40%. 2 out of 5. That's an amazing number. And according to the CDC, this adds about $140 billion a year to our nation's healthcare costs. Everybody involved in healthcare, the insurance providers, the healthcare providers, employers who are self-insured for their employees, all of these people have a stake in trying to reduce those costs by helping the individuals become healthier and live a healthier lifestyle. And obviously the insurance companies are no exception to this. An interesting new development is that the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, which is one of the largest health insurers in the country, they've recently announced that one of their programs called Blue 365, it's making it possible for their 60 million members to get Fitbit fitness band devices at a reduced price. This is a pretty enormous investment, but it means that these members may be able to increase their physical activity and lose weight and become healthier in the process. The importance of this news is not just for about Fitbit and not just about Blue Cross, but it's a strong indication that corporate America is recognizing the benefits of helping their employees and their members be more healthy and live a better, healthier lifestyle. These incentive programs to get them to exercise more, take better care of their health, are spreading rapidly and gaining a lot of traction. The main reason for that is that it's actually saving these companies money in the long run. So it shows up right there on their bottom line. So this is a way that hopefully the feedback will work in everybody's benefit and we'll end up with a population that is healthier, loses weight, and is able to save a lot of healthcare costs as a result.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Windows 10 was released in late 2015. And in late 2016, we had talked about the need to directly download the latest version of Windows 10 from Microsoft.com. Beginning with January 1, 2017, releases of Windows 10 will not upgrade Windows 7 or 8.1 for free. Actually, you can still upgrade for free if the Windows 10 build number was 1607 or 1507. However, these build versions are no longer available directly from Microsoft. The importance of having a copy of Windows 10 distribution prior to 2017 is the need to use it if you had to reinstall Windows 10. Just remember, when you upgraded from 7 to 10, the hidden partition still has Windows 7. And if you had a crash, how would you reinstall Windows 10? An example is when malware has literally rendered your operating system beyond repair or restore, and the official builds released to date are 1803, 1709, 1703, 1607, and 1507. For most people, they would simply do a factory reset to reinstall the original version of Windows 7 or 8.1 from the hidden partition. If you no longer have the hidden partition, however, just try upgrading the current operating system that you now have on the machine with the latest copy of Windows 10 build. That may or may not work. You may need to key in the serial number of the installed operating system. If you don't have that, look underneath your system for such information. So the big question is, still, where can I get a copy of Windows 10 build 1507 or 1607? A search on the internet didn't answer the question if the maintenance of an older version of Windows 10 was legal. There is such a site. WindowsISO.net. Let me repeat that. www.windows, that's with an S, ISO.net, all one word. If you have other systems running a different version of Windows 10, don't wait until it crashes to download the needed version of Windows 10 to reinstall. Download the inventory of ISO files you need. Once you have installed the older version of Windows 10, it will over time be upgraded to the current supported build. Or you can go directly to Microsoft.com to get all the updates to bring that quickly to the updated version of Windows 10. The economy's booming, and so too is the stock market, thanks in large part to the performance of Apple and its signature product, the iPhone. Millions of people have wanted one for over a decade now, and demand still appears pretty strong. Even old-school investor Warren Buffett, whose company Berkshire Hathaway now owns a big stake in Apple, and he has called the iPhone indispensable. But has our love affair with the latest and greatest tech, the iPhone in particular, gone too far? The results of a new survey from the personal finance website WalletHub indicates that might be the case, at least for many young consumers. Roughly 28 million Americans believe that getting one of the 2018's new iPhones is a must and it's worth going into debt. That opinion is especially pronounced among millennials as well as slightly older consumers. More than 18% of the people under the age of 45 say a new iPhone is debt-worthy, compared to 5% of those who are 45 and older. On the one hand, a new iPhone could be perceived as a good investment in an increasingly mobile economy when a person's social media presence can directly affect the ability to put money in the bank. iPhones are becoming more than phones. They're quite functional little computers. Economically, it makes sense to go into debt for items that deliver services over several years. If you tend to get a new phone every 3 years, however, then you shouldn't take out a 5-year loan to pay for it. In many young people's mind, the decision to incur debt to get a new iPhone may simply come down to which impacts daily life more. Debt is expensive, both in terms of interest owed and our ability to borrow for more important things in the future. But a cutting-edge smartphone provides a world of possibilities right now. Those are also a big reason why 44% of millennials believe that their cell phones has a bigger impact on their life than their credit score. Well, are they right? Their cell phones do have a big impact on their lives today, which when looked at over the course of their lives, probably does outweigh the impact of their credit score. Of course, for those millennials who are planning to own a home, a car, and other things that are typically acquired, debt is required and they may want to rethink their priorities. That's important because even though the economy is doing well overall, not everything about our finances have been fine in recent years. In particular, credit card debt and student loan debt has hit record highs, putting pressure on the very people who now seem comfortable borrowing to get, well, a cell phone. When you design something that's intended to enjoy a long future, it's easy to get confused. You don't have to design for the next several generations of things today to make that work. It isn't about designing from the future. It's about designing more future into what makes sense in the present tense. And by the way, this is very similar to the confusion that makes people think they need 4K TV sets when there's hardly any 4K content to watch. Hey, Marty, can you explain your phenomena about Barnum's?
From a technology perspective, our advanced house design qualifies as cybernetic at an unprecedented level. But if that's all we wanted to accomplish, well, the design process would be much, much simpler. Remember, we're also trying to be energy miserly, reducing the total cost of ownership to a significant degree. And an even bigger factor is that we're trying to make it all 40 years maintenance-free, meaning 4 decades without facing major repairs or replacements. And for some reason, the combination often confuses people. Obviously, we can't pop into a TARDIS and fetch the best technology of 40 to 50 years in the future. All of our designs are with things available in the present tense. We have to use things we can get now to design and build something that works now in a way that it will keep working for the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, and hopefully more. Hank suggests thinking of this The way you might think of a NASA deep space mission, no matter how many years a probe is designed to operate, it has to keep going using only the tech available before it launches. No pit stops for upgrades. We're trying to design the house kind of that same way. Same with us, at least philosophically. Of course, everything we're using will get better and cheaper and smaller and more highly integrated in the future. That's not a reason to design for failure and upgrades and replacements. Wait a minute. I take that back. I have to design for failures because failures always happen. And we do design for failures, mostly through redundancy. For example, of the scores of Raspberry Pi boards in the design, a good many are on standby, ready to take over for any of the other boards if there's a failure. And the software behind that wasn't even difficult to design. The hardest part is having a board tell you that it's failed. We found a way to do that. Now, at the end of 40 years, our technology may be regarded as curious, antiquated, museum candidates. No problem, as long as everything still works. You know, for example, we can, if we want, have wall outlet receptacles with built-in USB power ports. Should we? Well, no. There's no way to know what USB will be like even 10 years from now. Well, I have high confidence that AC power plugs will still look the same and still deliver the same line power 40 years from now, I am every bit as confident that today's USB power ports will be useless by then. Let me ask you this. How many of your printers today plug into Centronics parallel printer ports? How many of you get your internet connection over a 300 or 1200 or even 9600 bit per second analog modem? When's the last time you got a fax? Is there still an analog landline in your house? Does your PC have a PS2-style keyboard port? Does your keyboard have a plug that would fit one? When, if ever, have you used your computer's cassette tape recorder data interface? Or an 8-inch floppy disk? More or less 40 years ago, all of that was state-of-the-art in computing technology. The French have an aphorism. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Credit Jean-Baptiste Alphonse Kerr in his 1849 journal, The Wasps. Now run that thought in reverse, and you get a Marty Winston aphorism. You only ever really learn from your bruises. History tells us a lot about the future. The rate at which the specifics of tech go obsolete tells me that keeping up with the state of the art is off the table for what I need in this house. And let's not forget the interdependencies. Let's say that instead of thinking about doing it once to work for 40 years, I had wanted to make changes as the tech improved. I'll even simplify that. Let's say that all I wanted to change is the scores of Raspberry Pi boards with new models as those come to the market. Just in case I'm the only one who sees that as a briar patch, I'll give you some stipulations beyond what anybody should accept. Let's start with these. I'll stipulate that every future Raspberry Pi version will have the same GPIO pinouts, the same physical dimensions, and more or less similar hardware. If you haven't learned by now, when talking about future versions of today's products, the term more or less signals unexpected trapdoors. These are, by the way, unlikely stipulations in the long term. But to get to the more immediate point, here's what else there would be to deal with when boards like these get upgrades. Start with the OS. Every OS is hardware dependent. I have no expectation that the Linux distribution we use today will be perfectly compatible with a board that comes out years from now. With the OS comes the software. Even if the only thing we need to do is to replace all of our C++ code by recompiling it, well, it's unlikely, but let's go with that. Who will be around to replace 100 boards, change out the OS, recompile the software, and troubleshoot the combination? On the other hand, using Hank's deep space probe metaphor, what is there really that would compel me to put something newer in if what's already there simply works? New is an addiction. New is a temptation. Often, New is a humbug, a sucker play, a reminder of how absolutely right Phineas T. Barnum had been. And I just saw that at work a few weeks ago. Our living room TV set was working fine. Then it had a little glitch, a small change in performance that made us think that it might be time to replace it. That glitch? There was no more picture, nothing but a black screen. We headed to a discount superstore with lots and lots of TV sets, all fairly priced. They were on both sides of three aisles, arranged with the really huge screens in the far left aisle, the smaller bedroom or kitchen size screens in the far right aisle, and the mid-sized screens, our Goldilocks point, the ones we were interested in the middle. Now, I walked from the front to the back. I looked at every set, looked at its specs, and still walking quickly, I was repeatedly telling my wife, "Not that one, not that one, not that one," as we walked. When we got to the end, I said, "That one, and only that one." She asked why. I showed her that every other set was a 4K set. This was the only one there that was just an HD set, 1080p. She asked, "Hey, what's wrong with 4K? I told her the 4K is fine, but there's absolutely no 4K content available to us to watch. The cable service doesn't carry it. We don't have any 4K Blu-ray discs. So with nothing to watch in 4K, we have no need for 4K, and the under $400 HD set would be fine. We bought it. It is fine. And just in time. Our cable system just added BBC America. I'm really looking forward to seeing the next season of Doctor Who when she returns. But wait, stores aren't stupid. Why would every TV set but one be 4K if customers weren't demanding 4K? It's obvious. There's no denying it. They are demanding 4K. But why? Okay, maybe if you have gaming consoles that can output 4K. Most people don't. Maybe a few are seriously into video and have 4K cameras. That can't be many. I have to believe that the reason so many consumers buy 4K is because they believe they need to own 4K, that it has a purpose in the here and now, that they'd be sorry if they didn't own 4K. In other words, because they don't know any better. It may be different where you are, but I'm in Aiken, South Carolina, not the most metropolitan or urbane of communities. And in the population here of 31,000, not the level of technical sophistication of your own neighborhood. So let's give this round to Barnum. They think they should want 4K, so they buy 4K. Other than being unnecessarily out hundreds to thousands of bucks, what harm could it do? Well, let me spell out the parallels to the 40-year house confusion. It's a difference between living in the present and trying to live in the future tense before it's hatched. If you have a dictionary handy and you're not driving right now, look up the term premature. Or consider the phrase jumping the gun. It's like when a guy meets a pretty girl and before they even date buys her a house. Or renting heliport space atop an apartment building because somebody said that someday we would all own flying cars. Or being 5 years old and breaking out in pimples because in 10 years everybody else your age will be doing that. You don't need a 4K TV set before there's something 4K to watch. For that matter, did you get hornswoggled into buying a 3D TV set? How's that doing for you? Really, I'm not surprised. This is the same generation that throws its money at the crowdfunding panhandlers on Indiegogo and Kickstarter, maybe believing they're investing in something. Hey, people, don't you recognize by now how little of that stuff actually comes true? How few of those people know enough to successfully run a company, even if they get a product into manufacturing? How many of them never thought to investigate whether they're working on something that hardly anybody really wants to own? It's your money, and if you want to give it away to panhandlers, well, there are plenty in every downtown. It's the Barnum effect, and be thankful that I'm not extending the discussion into politics. So, in my cybernetic house design, how am I building for the next 40 years? Well, I'm really not. I'm building for right now, and I'm doing it in ways that I try to assure won't fail anytime soon. It has to do with understanding what makes things fail and avoiding those things, or choosing alternatives. It has to do with being redundant, so spares or alternatives can automatically take over if there is a failure. Belt and suspenders. It has to do with devoting resources to monitor all of the pieces that should be running to make sure they are running. It has to do with having more than one of anything important. So, one more message from Hank. Whether it's a day, a decade, or 40 years, the only safe way to jump into the future is to back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Westchester PC user group will have a presentation on why and how to easily create additional computers without having to buy any. Thursday, September the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, September the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scher Hall at the New York Institute of Technology out in Old Westbury campus on Old Westbury, New York. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on GNU Cache. What is GNU? GNU, not Unix. The meeting time is Thursday, September the 20th at 7 p.m. Please note that this is a change in date for this 1 month. They normally meet the second Thursday of each month. For the month of September, they're meeting on the third Thursday of September, meeting time 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place in Manhattan, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will meet Tuesday, September the 25th, meeting time is 7 p.m. in the community room, Princeton Public Library at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation by my colleague Alfred Poor, and he'll give a presentation on Healthy Worker, Happy Company, the Growing Role of Employee Health Monitoring. Thursday, September the 27th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet at the Middletown Library Computer Lab in Middletown Township Public Library, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, October 2nd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. They're meeting at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. All these meetings are free and open to the public. These computer clubs have random access sessions at each of their club meetings. If you have any questions or you have need for technical advice, the staff members are more than happy to assist. Just remember, in computing, there is no such thing as a dumb question. And I have some advice for computer user groups that want to have the announcement made. Just send me the information on the name of the club, topic of presentation, if any, day of the week, the date of the meeting and time, the venue of the meeting, and the location of the venue, and send the information to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. And I have advice for all the computer club announcements that I've been making. All the relevant information should be on the same page, preferably on the home page, because each time you change a home page, you increase the search factor and the location of the venue. And if you want to add to it, a map how to get to the location. We'll be seeing you at these meetings. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, it's essential you back up. Just remember, three things you have to do. Back up, backup, and backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.